Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the second motorsport commentary behind the scenes. The April 2017 edition is now on sale, so we're going to look back through the magazine and let you into some of the production secrets. I'm Ed Foster, and I'm joined by Deputy Editor Joe Dunn and Art Editor Damon Cogman. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
You are here. Good. So, a big issue of the magazine, this one, 196 pages, and it's the 2017 F1 season preview issue, which is packed full of travel tips, the new cars, driver lineups, and all the main talking points. But before we get to that, though, I wanted to just tell our listeners about an offer we've got, which is actually a pretty good one. We are offering all of you the opportunity to win a pair of tickets and other great prizes, including motorsport luggage, to the Hall of Fame Awards dinner. To be in with a chance of winning, simply vote for who you think should be inducted into the Hall of Fame at the ceremony in June. The great names include Villeneuve, Mansell, Costin and Duckworth, Barry Sheen, and many, many more. Please go to www.motorsportmagazine.com/vote. That's motorsportmagazine.com/vote. Alternatively, if you want to secure your place at the glamorous awards ceremony taking place at the Royal Automobile Club on June the 7th, then you can purchase your tickets online at motorsportmagazine.com/HOF. That's HOF for Hall of Fame. Or you can just simply call 0207-349-8484. You'll be rubbing shoulders with the stars whilst sipping champagne and watching this year's nominees being inducted into the Hall of Fame in front of their peers. It's one event this year which is not to be missed. Now, very importantly, the new issue, the April edition, is on sale now. And you can buy that straight from us on the Motorsport website. And we've got a short link for you, which is bit.ly, so it's bit.ly/MotorApril2017. That's MotorApril2017. That will take you straight through to the shop, and you can buy this issue, which, obviously, I'm very slightly biased, but I think it's absolutely worth it. You should take out a subscription, even better. Right, so the April 2017 edition. Damon, I'm going to come to you first, because on the front of this, we have a very menacing-looking Renault F1 car for 2017. However, it all looks very organised and beautiful, but it wasn't organised and beautiful in the run-up to this cover, was it?
No, it's like an iceberg. You just see the little tip of it, but there's a whole load of other stuff going on underneath. We set the wheels in motion for getting hold of images a little while before the testing started. We started by emailing all the teams to say we had a wonderful Formula One preview issue coming up, and would they help us out by forwarding over images and getting us everything that we needed to put together the best F1 preview we possibly could. And pretty much to a fault, they said yes, of course, no problem. It was all going really well. Unfortunately, they didn't really send anything through until the last moment. So we were kind of a little bit under the cosh when it came to deciding which car we wanted and getting the right images. As it turned out, we'd made a decision about wanting the Renault because they're the works team, and we wanted them to be front and centre. One of the easiest things to do would have been to choose the Mercedes or to choose the Ferrari, but as it was, we decided on the Renault, mainly because it was bright yellow, but mainly because we wanted to do something different. We thought other magazines and other people have already seen enough of Mercedes, and we wanted to maybe sort of really focus in on something different, give the reader something different.
Joe, excuse me for asking, but surely it was obviously a very tight deadline, but why can't you just change the deadline?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a question I've asked our publisher many times. The actual deadlines are set to sort of marry into and mesh with the printing process, which affects when the magazine is then going to be on sale on the newsstands and when it's going to be mailed out to subscribers. So although there's a little bit of flexibility, it may be a day or two, in this particular case, we were looking at moving the deadline back a whole week, which just wasn't feasible, which is why, as Damon was saying, we kind of tried to get the ball rolling as soon as we could, and hoping to get images and things sent to us, even if they were under embargo. In other words, ask the car manufacturers and the teams to send us the images on the promise that we wouldn't be publishing anything before they officially unveiled their new 2017 car, which obviously they wouldn't want to do. And we thought that was a fairly reasonable ask, but as it happens, a lot of the teams turned around and said, "Yes, you know, you can have the images, but we can't send them to you ahead of time because we're still bolting the cars together right up until the last minute." So it wasn't just us that were under the cosh; it was obviously the teams as well who were putting the finishing touches to their vehicles before the big unveil, and that was literally the first time the cars had been sort of seen properly screwed together and in the right livery and everything else. So there wasn't much room for manoeuvre.
I think, as I remember, the deadline for our cover was for it to go at 5 p.m. in the afternoon, and we received the images from the launch, the Renault launch, at, I think, was it 3 o'clock?
That's right.
I think.
So we had.
It took you 2 hours to do that.
I know. So it was a little bit tight, shall we say? Yeah. The usual thing about putting pictures on the wall and indulging in, oh, shall it be this one? Shall it be this one? No, it was. We're having this one. There's no debate. This is the one going on the cover.
And the interesting thing, I mean, it got to the stage where we actually thought that we could create a whole story around the race to get the car ready in time, particularly with Renault. We're talking with Renault, who are actually very helpful, and we're talking about having a journalist sort of follow the process of screwing the car together ready for the big launch date, which would have been quite good fun. But as you can imagine, things were so chaotic, it seemed, in the teams, that simply wasn't possible. But one for next year, maybe.
Yeah.
Now, before we go anywhere, Damon, I, on my shelving at home, much to my wife's delight, I have a whole series of motorsport magazines from 1950 to present. And there is a tiny, tiny little section that's red. yet this is, it's called the Red Era, even has its own name.
I think there should be a cartoon boo at this point. Yeah.
It is incredible how such a short stint in time can have such a lasting effect on people sort of talking about the magazine. We still get emails today saying, please don't ever go red again.
Can I just go on record and say it wasn't me?
Who's not here at the moment?
Yeah, so
the Motorsport logo is... it's an immovable object, isn't it?
It does appear to be now, doesn't it? Especially after that little period. The Motorsport green and the logo that it sits on is embedded, ingrained in our sort of magazine and in our sport. You know, the British Racing green is British motor racing. There's no getting around it. There was a period where, as you mentioned, the previous publisher, for right reasons at the time, decided that they wanted to try something different. As it turned out, the backlash and the reaction proved that it wasn't the best choice. But
I think the issues actually sold very well.
The issues did very well. Yeah. I mean, they were strong issues, and actually, and to be honest, the stuff in it was no different. You know, if you go back and take the covers off, they're the same motorsport through and through. But yes, I think the readers spoke, and they spoke that they wanted the green. We decided that was it was going to be green, and it would never stop being green. So whenever we do a little refresh, redesign, whenever we choose to sort of change it again, don't worry, it'll still be green.
But it's very rare for a magazine to have. I was going to say it has its hands tied behind its back, but I think that's perhaps a bit unfair to have such a recognisable masthead. As a designer, must be quite frustrating.
Yeah, I've always said it's a blessing and a curse, because the blessing is that if you're scanning through over the newsstands and you see Motorsport, the big green block, you know that it's there. You recognise it. There's an element of seeing that and being familiar with it, and you're comfortable with it. The downside is, of course, it's a big green block at the top of the magazine, and you can't sort of do anything to it. So creatively, it can be a little bit troublesome. But no, we just have to find ways around it, and that's what we do. So it's fantastic and a pain all at the same time.
No, nothing in comparison to doing a cover in 2 hours. No, so there we go. No reason to complain anymore. You've proven you can do it, so now we know.
Oh, no.
Joe, I'm going to fast forward to sort of pages, I think 17 and 18. We've got a piece on World Rallycross. It's really kind of jumped into the public consciousness, Rallycross, hasn't it? And it's not to the detriment of World's Rally Championship, but it certainly seems to be have more momentum at the moment.
It's having a moment, I think, Rallycross. I think it's hard to deny. I mean, you've obviously got some big manufacturers getting involved now, and you've got some well-known drivers. I mean, obviously, Petter Solberg's been involved for a while. Sebastian Loeb is involved with it now. There's a momentum to the sport, which I think has really kind of captured the public's imagination, and also captured, as I say, some of the big name manufacturers as well. So we're looking to do a bit more on it. It's an exciting sport. It lends itself as well to the kind of they're short races. It's a short course. It's fun. It's exciting. It's full of adrenaline. And it sort of lends itself to the kind of modern way of consuming sport as well. So I think it's probably going to grow more. So I'm looking forward to doing more about the sport in the magazine.
Mm. But Damon, you've been to quite a few World Rallycross events. But I suppose one of the great things is you can see the whole, most of the track, or if not all of it.
Yeah,
it's not like going to Spa and seeing all the cars disappear through Eau Rouge and then silence for a minute, whatever it is.
Yeah, we kind of get so used to a way of watching circuit racing where you enjoy watching them go past, seeing the field go through, and then waiting the 1, 2, 3 minutes depending on where you are, and seeing them again. But with Rallycross, it's a 6-7 minute race, and you get you can pretty much every event all over the globe now. You can see 90% of the circuits. When it comes to Lyddon Hill, if you stand in the right place, you can see the whole circuit. You can see every moment of it. So you get to see the whole race from start to finish at every point. And that's very much like watching it on TV. So we're kind of used to watching sporting events like that. But watching it in real life is an amazing experience. It's a really visceral thing. They're loud, they're noisy, you get filthy. You stand at a corner, you get covered in dirt. It's a wonderful thing. But it's not for everyone. It's not one for the purists. But it's great fun. And ultimately, it's kind of what it's all about, isn't it?
At least they're noisy.
Properly fun. With 600 brake horsepower, these cars. I mean, it's incredible seeing them in action.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, you mentioned Lyddon Hill, which is one of my favourite circuits, actually. And it's a lovely sort of small kind of circuit, but they're moving to Silverstone obviously next year, so it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it's good for Silverstone, I think, and hopefully it'll be good for Rallycross. We'll see how it works, how it pans out.
So moving ahead to Mark Hughes's column, pages 25 to 32, he's obviously writing about Formula One 2017 and Pirelli as well. What do you both think about the 2017 cars? I mean, let's just look from a sort of obviously from an aesthetic point of view, are they doing what they should be doing for you?
I was hoping that the changes would be a little bit more dramatic. I mean, I think that there's been quite a... It's always hard to tell in the lead-up to these sort of unveils, and obviously there was a raft of new regulations, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But just in terms of looking at the cars, I was hoping that some of the interpretations of those new regulations might be a bit more dramatic. But it's very much evolution rather than revolution, I think, with the look of the cars.
Yeah, aesthetically, they're not hugely dissimilar to what's gone before. There are a few little tricks here and there. I mean, the biggest thing is obviously the width and the size of the wings, but by and large, they're pretty much as they were before. So, yeah, disappointed that they're not more dramatic. But obviously, when you get to see them on the circuit, we'll come Australia first race. I'm sure that will go out the window, and we'll be jumping up and down in front of the telly with everybody else. So we can't wait for it to start, really.
Yeah. Well, I was lucky enough to go to the Barcelona test last Tuesday, and the cars do look dramatic. I think they look faster. It's quite hard to tell. I'm not going to claim to be able to see a 2 second difference in lap time between two different cars, but they do look good on track. The only worrying part was that obviously Mark's written a piece about Pirelli in the magazine, but he wrote a sort of follow up piece online, and he was saying that what Pirelli were tasked with was making tyres that if you backed off for a lap, then the grip would come back and then you could start pushing again. But what Pirelli has actually done is they've made tyres that don't degrade at all. So we're staring down the barrel of a lot of one-stop races, And because the cars have a lot more downforce to try and get these lap times down by 5 seconds, the cars are also going to be very difficult to overtake.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the more downforce does not necessarily make great racing. So not great news for all the fans hoping for many overtaking manoeuvres and exciting racing. We may not be looking at that. But in a way, I would prefer tyres that didn't degrade as badly as last year and the years that came before.
I think what you don't want is you don't want artifice, do you? You want to see pure racing, and that's what we're all here for. We all want to see the cars driven on the limit for longer, not being driven at 60% or 80% or in power saving mode and in tyre saving mode. You want to see them being driven flat out, and if the tyres allow that, then great. If they don't do as many stops, it's not so much of a problem, as long as the cars are being driven quickly and on the limit and by people that, you know, kind of, and you can see what they're doing. That's what we want to see.
Yeah. I think Mark has, over the years, Mark has made it his business to know and analyse in a way that I don't think any other writer really does, the importance of the tyre to racing. And I think the piece that he'd written in this month's magazine is kind of a follow-on from that. And he's really just looked at, you know, how important, what the impact will be, how important the tyres are going to be. Obviously, the cars have got more downforce than they ever have been before. They're heavier than they've ever been before. So the pressures and the stresses and strains on the tyres are going to be more significant, and they're going to have a much more significant kind of impact on how the race develops. So Mark's done a very, really nice piece and a very informed piece looking at what the possible outcomes of that are going to be.
Yeah. So one of the sort of main protagonists this year, I guess, is going to be Ross Brawn. And if we look forward to Richard Williams's column on page 40, then he has sort of, in a way, written a letter to Ross Brawn, giving him sort of tongue-in-cheek advice on how actually he can sort this sport. And the route he's sort of taken is to ban radios, which I think is, you know, it's been mentioned before, but it's a lovely piece, just stripping it right back to what people want to see, and that's they want to see sort of gladiatorial drivers coping with what's thrown in front of them, not some engineer on the line telling them, you know, which gear they should be in, you know, which corner they're losing speed on, and where they can actually catch some lap time. But it's a lovely piece by Richard, isn't it? Jack?
It is, and you know, I mean, you ask 100, you know, F1 fans, you know, what rules should change or what they would do to make the sport, you know, more interesting, and you get 100 different answers, and you know, everyone's got their, you know, theory. Richard Williams essentially has, as you say, gone back to basics, said, right, well, you know, essentially, you know, what we need is more driver involvement. We want to see the genius of the drivers. We want to be able to have a sport that kind of allows a driver to express himself, so that the best driver ultimately gets the advantage and wins a race. And he argues that the way to do this, or one of the ways to do this, is to strip out or to ban radio communication. And it's obviously been tried before in F1, and then it was quickly dumped. I mean, I feel, you know, on slightly kind of trumped up charges by the teams that it was, a safety risk, because they wouldn't be able to tell drivers if they, you know, were losing pressure or something. But actually, I think if it had been given a proper go, and as Richard argues in this piece, you know, you can make it work, and it would allow for that human element of the sport to come out much more clearly.
So moving on to Matt's column, just a couple of pages later, he's talking about the arrival of Maverick Viñales. Damon, he's an exciting little kid, this one, isn't he? He's Rossi's new teammate.
Rossi's going to have fun again, isn't he? every couple of years, a new pretender comes to take his throne, don't they? After having a period of time with Lorenzo, I think he's just looking forward to a bit of a break, isn't he? But I don't think he's going to have a quiet life with Maverick. Brilliantly titled, okay, hasten to add. But he's good. He's topped the test so far in the last couple of weeks. He's looking like the real deal. And I think what he scores highly on is his attitude. He's a very calm, he's very relaxed. He's not like Marquez, where he's very emotional and kind of showy offy. He's just quiet, studious. He's going to get on with the job. And there's an argument to say he's going to give Rossi a lot more trouble again. So expect fireworks, yeah. I think, probably about mid-season when he's sort of banging into wheels with banging fairings with Rossi, then I think the tide will change again.
Yeah, it's interesting because Matt Oxley, Freddie Spencer and I did a season preview podcast, which is going to be online later this week. But Freddie Spencer was very interesting what he was saying about Vinales and Marc Marquez. He was saying that when Marc Marquez came into MotoGP, he made the likes of Lorenzo and Rossi raise their game, and they had to find this new level. And he said Marc Marquez has never had to find a new level. He just came in on the level that he was on. But he said the one person I think will make him find a new level is Maverick. And yeah, he said that's bad news for the likes of Rossi and Lorenzo.
Yeah, because I'm not sure who Rossi's got many right. more levels to go.
We were saying that about 10 years ago, yeah. right? So you never know. But it's very interesting. So a small sneak peek there for the podcast coming out later this week. So into the features and onto page 65 with a feature on cheating. Winning is all that matters, it's titled. Joe, where did this come from? Why now? Why it's obviously very worthy feature. I think very interesting because cheating has been around as long as motorsport has been around.
Yeah, yeah.
But why now?
Well, two reasons really. I mean, I think the initial idea was sparked after Mark Hughes's interview with Pat Simmons from last month's issue, where Pat talked a lot about the about Crashgate and Nelson Piquet Jr. and what his role in was that was in it and how it had tarnished his career and Pat Simmons' career, but he went into quite a lot of detail about it that we hadn't read before, and so we thought this was a really interesting kind of topic and a really interesting area, and how can we make a little bit more of it, and we didn't want to put all the focus on this one incident because obviously millions of words have been written about it, but we decided to kind of expand it and make it into a more general sort of piece on scandals have affected all types of motorsport, and the more we thought about it, the more it kind of crystallised into an idea, and then we also had the idea of having a Formula One preview looking forward to a bright future for racing, and so we wanted to have this idea of the sort of light, the darkest days of Formula One, looking forward to a bright future, and so throw it all into the kind of the magazine mix together. So that's how it all started, and Pat spoke to us and to Mark about that particular scandal, and then we've had and then we looked into all the other scandals as well, and there's scandals from karting to the WRC, to saloon car racing, to NASCAR. So we went to town on all of them, and there are some serious sort of cheats going on, but also some of them are a little bit more lighthearted and a little bit more kind of unexpected, shall we say.
I don't want this to be taken the wrong way, but I do love I like the fact that there's cheating in motorsport. There's still that kind of desperation to win at all costs, and I love some of the some of the stories we've got in here and the content. Such wonderful stories of kind of engineering genius. And, even Toyota's competitors in the WRC, when they got thrown out, said, I've got to tip my hat to them because really great effort. And that's what I love about motorsport. Yeah. It's just costs.
It's been a part of it since day one. Since the first racing was invented, there's been cheating. It's how much we dislike it or like it, depending on how you look at it. It's an integral part. It's been in the same way that it is with any competitive environment. There's always going to be somebody trying to push the boundaries, trying to go that one step further. And you can't bury your head in the sand. It happens. It will continue to happen long after we're gone.
Well, apparently the air restrictor that Toyota had fiddled with or re-engineered apparently still has pride of place at the FIA headquarters, and Max Mosley described it as one of the a genius piece of engineering. So, I mean, there are. There comes the point about the piece, I suppose, is that sometimes engineers love to push, love to interpret the rules to get the most advantage, to wring the most advantage out of them. But every now and again, they will cross that line, and that's really what the piece is exploring.
Yeah. So we then roll into the Formula One season preview, all 20 pages of it, and not only has Mark taken a sort of forensic look at all the cars, the teams, and the drivers, but the one thing I really like in this one is that it's got some travel information on it. Having been to the test in Barcelona, Jack Phillips, the online content assistant, and I decided to see how cheaply we could go and watch Formula One cars in action. So we set off to Barcelona just for the day. And, there's so many people say, well, Formula One is just totally, it's out of reach, I can't afford it. But we've done this double-page spread on a guide to all the costs, and it's all broken down to everything, to how much a beer costs in that country. And I must say thanks to Michael, our intern, for this, who's put a lot of the facts and figures together. But it's fascinating. It is an extremely expensive sport to go and watch. Then again, when you look at the cost of a few Grand Prix and a season ticket for Arsenal, it doesn't seem quite...
Why Arsenal? It's got to be...
doesn't look quite so ridiculous.
I wonder why.
I should just say that I have no idea about football. But Damon, I was actually going to come to you, and at the back of this, we got something that's a bit different that I wanted to focus on, was when Matt met Mark. This is when Matt Oxley met Mark Hughes, and they basically... It's a very interesting piece. It's just a sort of a conversation that we've transcribed about with Matt and Mark talking about their respective sports, MotoGP and Formula One, and how they differ and who the kind of the young chargers are, the sort of the Verstappens, the Vinales and Marquez, and how the sport is governed and run. And it's a bit different, isn't it, Damon? It's not your usual season preview stuff.
No, I mean, Mark and Matt come from very different worlds. I mean, Matt's been involved with the MotoGP and before that, when it was before it was even called MotoGP, he's been involved with that side of things for many, many years. For those of you who don't know Matt that well, he actually rode competitive bikes. He won races. He's won the TT. There's nothing he doesn't know about motorbikes. And Mark's the same. Mark's albeit not driven a Formula One car in anger, but there's nothing he doesn't know. So the two of them going at it was fascinating to hear. It was like kind of them sparring against each other. It was fascinating to listen to, but. The rather interesting story about this is that that Matt went up to go and interview John McGuinness, which is actually over the page.
Yeah, 104.
There we go, 104. And he met up with Mark beforehand, or he's going to meet up with Mark afterwards. When Mark and Matt sat down together, what was supposed to happen was that they were going to get together after Matt had gone up to interview John McGuinness for our Lunch With feature. And what happened was that because John was so late and didn't turn up till much, much later, I think he'd been out on his quad bike, hadn't he?
He'd been out on his dirt bike, and he had no reception. So despite having a mobile on him, it was totally useless.
Typical bike races.
And so he'd totally forgotten doing Lunch With Matt Oxley.
Yes, I think. Sorry, we're jumping ahead here, but yeah, the great thing about the two of them getting together was that they come from very different worlds, but actually they kind of share a common goal, which is they kind of love their sport. They love their element of that sport. And Matt sort of pitched the questions to Mark, and Mark pitched the questions to Matt. So it's a good to and fro. It's a different way to do it, but yeah, it's something that is a really interesting way to do it.
Yeah. And you can almost hear the sort of envy in Mark's kind of voice towards the end of the piece, where they start talking about the money involved in their respective sports. And obviously bike racing is a completely different kind of planet, really, to Formula One in terms of the spend. And Mark's saying to Matt, you know, but you know, you can still get into the paddock and meet all the drivers. And Matt's saying, yeah, of course I can. You know, yeah, that's what we do. And Mark's saying, well, you know, that's not how it happens in Formula One. You know, you have to, everyone's sort of roped off, and it's much more difficult, you know, to get access and to feel part of a group of fans, which obviously is very much the feeling you still get at MotoGP events. And so that kind of comes across towards the end, and I sort of sense a little bit of envy, really, that Mark's sort of thinking, well, that's maybe what my sport has lost a little bit of.
Yeah. Well, it's talking to Matt about it, you're talking about sort of the lack of sponsorship for some of the teams and how difficult it is for the MotoGP teams to actually find sponsorship, and not much money being in the sport compared to something like Formula One. And he said, you know, let's hope it carries on that way. Because when money comes, that's when the restrictions arrive. That's when you can't get into paddock. That's when, you know, local celebrity is more important than one of the riders. And he said that's what MotoGP isn't, and he never wants it to be. I'm sure they might have said that. Well, Ken Tyrrell did say that about Formula One years and years ago. So it's a bit late for Formula One. But now, Damon, I'm going to put you on the spot here.
No.
We're going to turn to page 88 and 89. I'll give you a chance to flick to those pages. Yes. Right. So now, just to let all you listeners know, we do occasionally get emails in the office complaining about our art editor, putting white text on a black background because it's extremely difficult to read. What Damon has done on page 88 and 89 is put white text on blue background, so slightly different.
Yeah, well, it's not black.
obviously, I know it's from a design, I guess, design perspective here. This is with your design hat on. This is why you do it. I guess glutton for punishment.
This is the bit where I'm going to have to defend my creativity, aren't I? All I would say in my defence is it. First of all, it looks great. Obviously, I will say that. But what I try and do is, if you may notice, if we're going to get really nuts and bolts about this, what you can do is you can actually see the difference between the type on the left and the type on the right. So the type that's in the right is actually quite a lot heavier, quite a lot thicker.
Well, the white text.
The white text.
Right.
Than the type that's actually the black type on the sort of the goldy colour.
So that, in a way, is an admission of guilt.
I would say I'm
the fact you've had to bold up the text.
This is an argument I'm never going to win, isn't it? All I can say is I can read it well, and I've got decent eyesight. I wave it under Gordon's nose. Gordon's a good barometer of this stuff. If he can read it, then most people can read it. So Gordon, in his absence, is being blamed for this. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry for putting you on the spot there. So we're going to sort of roll on through because we're running out of time. But obviously, we talked about Lunch with John McGuinness. This is actually a really lovely Lunch with that Matt has written. It's actually quite different because while it takes you through John's career and how he got to where he's got to. It goes a bit beyond that, and you know, he talks about his relationship with other drivers, with drivers such as Lewis Hamilton, Mark Webber, other riders, the likes of Valentino Rossi, and it's a bit different in that respect because I think his story is actually so well known and has been told so many times that it's a really lovely piece. But we've talked about that, and I'm going to move on to pages 112 to 118, and this is a perfect display of a journalist having a lovely time. This is when Simon Aaron, our features editor, went over to the USA and visited Daytona for the 24 hours. But being Simon Aaron, he didn't just go and watch the race. He decided to do a road trip and look at lots of the local dirt tracks and some of the local races and some of the sort of the history around and about, of which there is loads. Obviously, the beach is just the start of it. But Damon, you've been to Daytona. It is an impressive place, isn't it?
It's enormous. I think I was driving past it and I looked out the window, and then about 5 minutes later, I looked out the window again and I was still driving past it. It was the scale of it is mind-boggling. It calls itself, in true American style, the World Centre of Racing, which is which is fair enough. I think it's scale-wise, it's probably...
That's Lydon Hill, isn't it?
It's absolutely massive. The place is amazing. It's you can't really describe the scale of it until you see it for yourself. But the atmosphere, the noise, because you're in this bowl, it just echoes everything that sort of is great about motor racing. The noise, the spectacle, the smell, the sights, it all happens at 200 miles an hour around Daytona. So it is a fantastic place. However, I didn't go and see the things that Simon saw, which...
No, it's an amazing mix of stuff. So the magazine is almost worth buying just for this alone in terms of the amount of things he managed to go and visit. Simon is known for leaving the office on a Friday evening, maybe having a glass or two of white wine, and then driving all over the country, seeing about four different race meetings in the UK or even further afield. So he's basically flown over to America and done exactly the same thing. Now, it's sort of second last one up is a piece called Playing Catch Up on 122. And this is Mark Hales, who's tested sort of two American specials, which are kind of amazing machines. Joe, just tell us a bit about this piece and Mark Hales testing his cars.
Before we get to that, I think we ought to just skip back a little bit and just talk about Dickie Meaden's picture.
Yes, of course.
If we can. And this is Richard Meaden, who has joined us and has written his first column, actually, introducing himself to the readers. And this is his feature, which is a brilliant test drive, or track test, really, of... the old Lotus 26R, which he has raced successfully. And he, when he was originally pitching this, he said, you know, we call it the mongoose. And we said, you know, why do you call it the mongoose? As well, because it had such an appetite for cobras in its day. So, of course, that was the headline immediately. And he's done a fantastic piece, and really hope. I mean, hopefully, readers will sort of, you know, be able to relate to it as well. And nobody really can write about sort of driving cars and racing cars in the way that Dickie can. And you know, he's a very handy driver in his own right. But he writes just so beautifully about it. So we've got some lovely pictures and a really good read, which is sort of Dickie's debut for Motorsport.
Yeah, and it's a car that's got lots of history as well, and that story is told as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thank you for reminding me of that, Joe, but I'm going to draw you back to the Mark Hales track test of the American Specials, and it's one of those sort of opening spreads when you open it up and you see these two cars and you do immediately think, what are those? Because they are a bit different, aren't they?
They are. They look like nothing else you've seen. I mean, originally we were sort of thinking a lot. We were trying to think of a fun headline around the sort of over here, overpowered and oversexed, or over sexed and over here and overpowered, or over the top. but something along those lines. We didn't manage to make it work in the end. But that is essentially what these things are. I mean, they are incredible to look at, and they are from that era of hot rodding, where the Americans sort of started putting these enormous engines in their chassis, and but there wasn't as much of a scene as there was over here, and I think that this piece, Mark's done a great job of kind of documenting these cars as they came over for a flying visit and driving them at Silverstone.
Yeah, they're certainly unique.
Yeah, they sound amazing. They don't look the best, but they by their own admission, I think somebody commented that they looked like they were built not in a shed but out of a shed. So I think so.
but they, yeah. So there's that piece, and then right at the back, sort of last of the features, our editor Nick Trott went off and interviewed Tommy Mäkinen, which is a lovely little piece and a one-on-one interview with the great rally driver.
Yeah, he kind of managed to catch up with Tommy when he went to the Monty a few weeks back, which I think you mentioned last time. But he managed to get some time with Tommy, who's actually a lovely sort of gently, softly spoken, gentle guy, which you wouldn't have thought if you'd have ever seen him in period. He was four-time world rally champion. And the way that he threw that for those of you with memories can remember him throwing that Evo around was quite a sight to behold. So I think he was tempted to sort of get behind the wheel, but I think he's realised that he's going to leave it to the young kids now and sort of retire gracefully. But I think he was involved in the testing of it. I think by all counts, by the people that mentioned it, said that he was still pretty quick.
Yeah, never quite lose it, do you?
No.
What comes across as well is how he's sort of brought the skills and the determination and focus that he had as a driver into sort of making into a team owner, and how he's sort of managed to inspire those around him in this new role, because it's obviously very difficult for a driver to go from being a great driver to what happens next, and Tommy's obviously managed to do it, albeit within motorsport, but it's a fascinating read.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of drivers did not manage it so well, yeah. I have to say. So well done to Tommy. Yeah. Well, look, Joe, thank you so much for joining me. Damon, thank you so much for all your words and insight. Don't forget, everyone, that you can buy this issue that we've been talking about right now on the Motorsport website. You can go to the Motorsport website and click on the shop tab at the top, or you can go to the short link that I mentioned earlier, which is bit.ly. So that's bit.ly/MotorApril2017. There's plenty more over and above what we've talked about, including the best car David Brabham has ever owned, a 1979 VW Beetle. Who would have thought it? Amazing what you'll find within the pages of Motorsport, eh? So thanks so much for listening. Thank you so much for continuing to buy the magazine. And we'll see you all soon for another Motorsport commentary. Bye-bye.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.